Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 29th of August. Very nice to have you with us on this day. It is, we had a lot to talk about. We have a lot of people. We have a little bit of a shortened time. The governor will be coming on at 10 o'clock, so we'll get right to it. We'll abandon all the other tomfoolery. and go right into the crux of the program. A quick reminder, you can join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir.
Hey.
Good morning. Daily good Freeman publisher. Yeah, well, go ahead. Say good morning.
No. I was going to say something about, you know, being at the Guthrie Center on Saturday night. But why prolong the agony?
It's I believe it's at 8 o'clock. Is that correct?
Yes, that's at 8 o'clock at the Guthrie Center. It's a benefit for the Guthrie people. It's the Berkshire Ramblers.
413-528-1955 is the telephone number, and you can also go to GuthrieCenter.org. Okay. Ira Fussville, what will you be playing on Saturday night?
I'll be hopefully digging into a steak.
There you go.
By
Daily
myself.
Daily, Daily Freeman, publisher emeritus, Ira Fussville. Investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo joins us. Good morning,
Ira. Good morning. Good.
You seem clipped.
I want to get into the crux of the matter.
Okay, all right, very good.
Let's get into it.
Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly, good morning.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you here. And Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, making the rest of us feel really stupid, Jim Henler, good morning.
It's all artificial intelligence.
Yeah, well, it still sounds good on a resume, but thank you. All right, let's get to it. A lot going on, as you very well know, and if you don't, I'm impressed. Good for you. Let's start. We were just talking about this yesterday, but Kirsten Gillibrand decided finally to drop out of the race yesterday. I say finally because many people had been calling for her to drop out for several weeks. She had a fairly well-organized departure. There was a press release ready to go. She has a organization set up to help women win in the coming elections, and is going to be doing a lot of that as well as continuing to be our senator here in the state of New York. Alan, sensing you may have something to say on the subject, I'll begin with you.
You're a senator because I live in Massachusetts, but this was preordained. Obviously, I have no idea what the heck she was doing there in the first place. I don't think she did either. She's already announced that she might be willing to be the vice president. I don't think that's going to happen either. I don't know what she brings to it. So it really turns out not to have been a productive thing for her to do, I have to say.
No, way premature.
Way wrong.
Man, but as John McLaughlin would say, wrong.
Boo, boo.
Well, while I'm at it.
I'm
not her biggest supporter, but she's been a decent senator, and I believe that she did do it for a reason. I think she made an investment in her future. I don't think she hurt herself. She didn't say anything stupid. She increased her name recognition nationally, and so she's not going to be president now. She must have known that going in, but she's got a future. She's 52 years old. And so I give her credit for doing it. I mean, I wish the system was different because there are just so many people out there. But nevertheless, it's slowly shrinking. And I feel she was very admirable in what she did.
I know that you are not sexist, Alan. I know that very much. However, you did not say these same sort of things about Isley or Seth Mouton, who also, what did they bring? Why did they do it? They must have known going in. You didn't say those things.
Well,
men are allowed to stand in and make an attempt, are not.
I see you can never make a criticism, and I accept that because if I'm a man and I criticize her for what I consider to be, you know,
look what happened to Al Franken. I just bring that up.
So I want to say there's something very important she brought to the table. Namely, she changed the national conversation about how we treat women, how we speak to women, how women are treated in the military, how sexual assault is sort of thought about and framed in the larger conversation, and she's brought up consistently issues about families and burdens on women that are fully employed and run the family affairs. So she's brought a ton to the national conversation.
Okay, you hissed through that whole thing, Alan. You hissed through it.
Do I get to answer that?
Because yes, and we're going to be hissing behind you.
Well, and my, come on.
Jim and I are going out.
my issue on this is, if she's so good, Vera, how come she couldn't get anywhere above 0 to 1% in terms of the national conversation?
Okay, let me just say one thing. This country has not had a female president. There's a larger conversation to be had about not listening to women and not giving women opportunities and putting them down. And she, as Senator Gillibrand, has changed the national conversation in many ways. So I want to recognize the fact that we have finally some women that have changed the way women, mothers, and professional women and mothers are talked about. Women in the military and how their treatment is talked about broadly. Now, she's brought that to the table, which has permanently changed the way we think and talk about it.
For the same reason Jay Asley and others in the field of 25, it does not mean that you are not good if you could not get above a 1% or 0% in a field that huge.
If she's changed the conversation, look, I'm all for Kamala Harris being either president or vice president. Let me say this, and I think she should be vice president.
Why?
She be president?
Yeah. Because she's extraordinarily bright, extraordinarily assertive.
Kristen Gillibrand is not bright?
Yeah. Well, I don't think she's shown it, to be honest with you. And I think that that's why she's out. She's not out because she was good at it. She was out. She's out because she didn't make the cut. Let's face it. So, I think...
We know that. I mean, these are not arguments that
we're
bringing up.
You're not going to pin that on me. That's ridiculous. I'm all for Kamala Harris being either president or vice president. It is that Gillibrand went out there. She didn't get any support whatsoever from anyone in the New York State political realm. How come? If you're so right about that, how come?
Well, neither has Biden. Neither most in the Democrat.
Oh, Biden certainly has. He's got the governor of the state of New York.
He doesn't. In a field of 25, Democratic bigwigs are going to wait to see a lot more clearly who's going to come out ahead.
But don't tell me, Rosemary, that she doesn't have it. That she doesn't have anybody in New York. So what about Cuomo? I mean, Cuomo, I asked him, what about Gillibrand? Quiet, real quiet.
And de Blasio, too. I don't see you blasting de Blasio the same way.
You better open up your ears. You better open up your ears and get something to get the wax out of them.
I think Vera is right. There's just something very different in the way we discuss women candidates and in the way we discuss male candidates, failing and succeeding.
You know, Elizabeth Warren, for the longest time, was described as shrill, alienating to a lot of people. There are always special ways undermine women candidates. As everybody knows, I'm not a supporter, never was, of Gillibrand, but I find it really difficult to swallow the fact that she contributed nothing to the national conversation. And that is where have to disagree.
Who said that? Well, who said that? I mean, there's nothing like putting words in somebody else's mouth. And I resent it. You said, the assertion you have just made is not true.
God, you're acting like a woman, Alan. You're getting very emotional.
I'm concerned that you guys are pulling this nonsense.
Well, I just think you've sold Gillibrand way too short. She made an effort. It didn't pick up steam. She didn't embarrass herself. She's got a long career ahead of her in politics. And rather than knock her for having as little support as she had, I give her credit for the effort and for knowing knowing that it was time to get out now and start clearing the field. There are other good candidates out there. There are other strong women candidates out there. As I said, I just think you sold her a little short. I have no particular love for her. I've only met her once. She wandered into our office some years ago by herself when she was running for Congress. Found her perfectly likable, but she's really evolved and she's gotten to be a very strong person. I wasn't crazy about the Al Franken situation, but I understand where she was coming from. So I just think we're doing her a disservice if we make her seem like a nothing here.
And I would just throw in that I think, you know, it certainly did not hurt her on the New York scene to be seen as a national player.
How do you know that?
At this thing. We certainly haven't seen polling or anything that shows negatives in the state that I've seen.
I don't know that they're polling on that particular question.
Well, that may be.
I don't think the visibility could have.
I don't know if it helped her. It certainly hasn't hurt her. But I think the key point being that, you know, I think it's great we have a strong senator, and I hope she will consider
who may be stronger than the senior senator.
I agree. I mean, she is consistently focused on a number of issues that most other candidates ignore, and that I really appreciate about her.
The other thing too is during the debates, she was certainly during the first debate, but in the second debate as well, she went outside the box of the rules and started questioning people directly, including Joe Biden. You wonder who will take that up now, of who will sort of be the attack dog.
Well, wait a second. You don't think, Joe, that Kamala Harris didn't do that? She did, and she got a lot more credit for having done it than Gillibrand did.
The formats of these debates so far haven't really lent themselves to much back and forth. There has been some, such as what Alan just referenced. But now we're the next debate, there are going to be 10 people, and it'll go a little bit more narrower. That's when the real action mm-hmm. is. This is just playing footsie right now.
Yep. The next debate is going to look just like the last four.
Well, that's correct in that there's only one night of 10. But now you're going to have all of the main players on the stage at the same time rather than split over two nights.
Right. Now we get to see who the main players really are in comparison to each other and perhaps get more insight how they would do with an argument that is a little more narrow in comparison to
Professor,
a competitor. Yes, you're a professor too, aren't you?
Yes, so you can call me that. Professor, I wanted to ask you a question. You mean to say that we don't know who the main players are right now?
Well, I didn't say that. I said the main players are on the stage together, and now we will see how the main players are competing with each other in a narrow, when they're very narrowly different from each other, several of them.
You have Biden, Sanders, Harris, yep. Buttigieg, Castro, yep.
Exactly.
Booker, all on the mm-hmm. same stage.
Yes.
Which you didn't have before.
We haven't heard them before at the same evening, and now we get a better sense of how they have to distinguish themselves from each other. For example, Warren and Bernie Sanders, and perhaps on some issues, Buttigieg and Biden, and it'll be very interesting.
Well, see, I'm fascinated by what Bernie is doing now. We discussed it on the Media Project this week. And the issue is Bernie has come out with a very complete plan on the media and the consolidation of the media. And I think that's in reaction to the fact that Warren is so specific in terms of her programs. And Bernie realizes that it was incredibly important that he do substantive stuff as well as just angry stuff.
Well, we saw that with the Green New Deal. You do have to wonder whether the media stuff came after his dust up with the Washington Post.
Yeah.
It's a good plan. I don't know. Alan is more interested than I am in motivation. It is a really good plan. And the fact that we have national candidates running for president talking about the First Amendment and support of the media can only be a good thing.
So, Rosemary, you don't think motivation becomes important in any of this? Because I think the American people are very concerned about what motivates people to do things. Is it self-serving or is it genuine?
No, I think the political system is set up so that you either do things to serve yourself or to pander to people whose support you want. And that's fine by me as long as it gets done.
When you think about this, so you had said 25. So now we're down to 20. Well, only 20 candidates, Rosemary. Jeez, we're down to only 20. So we can assume that with this debate announcement that probably that number will get a little bit smaller, and then we'll we'll see what happens.
I think people are really tired of all these choices, and they want it to get down to the real players quicker.
And we can only those of us who do not want to see this president reelected can only hope that the remaining Democrats and going forward treat themselves in such a way as to not shoot the party and themselves in the feet and hurt their chances of being elected. Going to be a fine line that they have to walk between showing their differences in policy and demeaning each other to the point where they will make people who are on the fence look the other way.
A point I have made many times, particularly after that second debate last time around, in which they really tried to kill each other. It was just awful.
But that's certainly not going to change probably as it gets tighter and you get fewer people and the numbers get closer.
Well, it is interesting that that Bernie refuses to go after Warren. Big story in the paper this morning that when provoked and when reporters tried to get him get Bernie to go after Warren, he would not do it. I think that spoke extremely well of him.
Well, he didn't go
after. I think it was self-interest. Yeah. He's got a problem with women. He has a problem that he went after Hillary so viciously and for so long.
Wait.
And he has to be careful with women.
Rosemary, are you the one who said you're not interested in motivation?
No, and you are the one who is interested. That's why I bring up the point.
I think it's a good time for a break. Let's.
What's your motivation?
Yeah, what's your motivation?
Our motivation is we
I think
all
the last
20 coffee.
Minutes has been a fine example.
The governor on the phone yet.
Let's take a break. We'll be right back. We welcome your comments. Panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. All right, we've had a break. Everybody's had a little calm down, had a little coffee. We're good. I think we're better now. I'm going to read some letters, and I'm just going to stir all this stuff up again.
You're nuking the hurricane.
I'm nuking the hurricane. I go on, I just want to, on behalf of all of us, wish Ira and his lovely wife a very happy anniversary.
Oh, how do you know about that?
Yeah.
I read social media, my friend.
Oh, man, you're the one.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. 48. Well, the joke, of course, is we've been married 40 happy years. 40 out of 48 is not bad.
And to which Alan just said yesterday, there is no joke. So let's go. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
To both of you. Mike writes in and says, at this point in the Democratic nominating process, I am looking for someone to inspire me in the same way Bobby Kennedy did, Barack Obama did. Gillibrand did not inspire me in the way Mayor Pete does, the way Kamala Harris does. Right now, those inspire me to want to get out and work for them. Right now, inspiration is the benchmark I'm looking for.
I like that letter.
Leslie says, you like this one better. Leslie says, I agree with Alan on the subject of Gillibrand. I think she's done more to hurt the voices of women by treating every example of accusations of sexual assault, credible or not, the same. In my opinion, she has done more to diminish the Me Too movement than to help it. She has always been a lightweight. Kamala Harris is my first choice. Sue said, I'm not a Gillibrand supporter, but I feel like the media are choosing our candidates. I like the governor of Washington State. I mean, that's a fair point, because with the stuff about polls and debates and those choosing the candidates who get up there and when they get out, it does feel
that
way.
It's a fair point.
Yeah. Rachel says, thank you to Vera and Rosemary for bringing up the unequal and ridiculous treatment of female candidates. To say that Gillibrand, a U.S. senator with many accomplishments, was ridiculous to get into the race is a great demonstration of the misogyny that women running for office face. Running for president as a U.S. senator is not a reach. Face it, any woman in the race is expected to be perfect, and the men Even mayors of small towns can just try.
Nice job, Rachel.
Dean says, the idea that we as a country look at women candidates differently than men was put to rest in 2016 when Hillary Clinton won the popular vote.
There
sexism,
is that.
Like other issues, only remains so because some people continue to bring them up.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Mary, do you want? Are you still? You're trying to digest that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mary said, Alan, on your commentary this morning, you said you were sure that Kamala Harris would be the VP candidate. I'm not so sure. I think that Elizabeth Warren will choose a male VP to balance her ticket. Daisy says, I got to say, Alan, I find your constant crowing about Harris very odd when Elizabeth Warren, who is heads and shoulders above Harris in the polls and in terms of policy, grasps so much more. Why don't you talk about her? It feels like this is all about wanting to make Harris Biden's VP.
Well, fair is fair. I have talked about my incredible admiration for my senator over and over again. I think she's terrific. And I think she may well be the vice presidential nominee. I think the thing that Harris brings is bicoastal. In other words, she's at the other end of the country. She's California. She's prosecutorial. And when she goes out to face Trump, which is a traditional role of a vice presidential candidate, goes out against the other guy, she's going to be terrific. So that's why I admire her so much.
All right. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. All right. Now on to the next story we go. So we talked about Boris Johnson yesterday. Now the outcry has begun over the plan to suspend Parliament. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson sparked angry talk of a coup Wednesday after he moved to shut down Parliament for several weeks in an extraordinary effort to silence rebel lawmakers and ram through Britain's departure from the European Union. The decision to shutter the legislature for more than a month, starting no later than September 12th, stifled dissenters as the days ticked toward Britain's most momentous deadline in generations. Outraged lawmakers say it concentrates power in Johnson's hands and sharply curtails their ability to thwart a no-deal Brexit. Some spoke of a constitutional crisis. Two words there, Vera Akarios-Kelly, constitutional crisis and coup.
Well, I have to say, a highly unusual move that Boris Johnson pursued, obviously. And more than anything, I would say the target audience is the European Union, because he's really trying to put pressure on the EU to renegotiate Brexit, because the Europeans obviously are deeply concerned about this sort of, you know, no-deal Brexit, because it will have immediate and devastating economic repercussions for a number of European countries, not only the UK. And I think Boris Johnson plays an incredibly dangerous gamble.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also convinced that the European Union is going to call his bluff, not renegotiate, mm-hmm. and he will have to face opposition that is forming around the sort of highly unusual move to close down or suspend Parliament.
So what do you expect to have happen?
Well, we see already today a lot of organization around the opposition. If he loses a number of his allies in his current administration, there will be a call of a vote of no confidence, possibly a new election. The European Union then might provide an extension to this whole debate. So this is a highly risky gamble for him, and it's all about himself and his own future. That is the most devastating thing.
So what should he have done, Vera?
Well, I mean, the fact is that he went to the European Union. He tried to get a new deal. The European Union said no. He had very little opportunity because he had such a grandiose mouth about wanting
He should have supported Theresa May, who was actually being the,
exactly.
being the logical one. You know, he gives me an appreciation for Trump because I have no dog in that fight.
Yep.
So I see the entertainment value. He's taking bold gambles. He's putting everything at risk. It's like watching a gambler in a reality game. It's kind kind of fun when you don't have to worry about like your future and your economy.
Except we have to worry about it. It's going to affect our economy tremendously.
Yes, but he got to be the leader.
Yes, and I guess he wants to go down in history books. That's his big thing.
We're all sitting. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure you will. We have not seen any potential answer. Every time either Theresa May or anybody else comes up with a compromise, it is rejected. What is the guy, Vera, you're the professor, what is the guy supposed to do now? It's not that he should have supported May. He's here now. What should he do now?
Well, it depends if he wants to do something positive for the country or if he wants to do something for himself. It looks like he's in it for himself because the only thing you can gain from a hard Brexit is economic devastation, poverty, and he doesn't care because he has money and he can fly out and leave. So for him, this is not a big deal. He just likes to play games. He, you know, his hair, for example, this is all a freaking farce because he has regular hair, except when he does interviews, he messes it up and towels, you know, it's just all the sort of appearance. It's all part of the gamble, the show, the performance. I mean, everybody who went to Eton with him knows that he's been behaving like this before. He's in it for himself, not the
dining experience.
Yeah.
So, let me just quickly ask a question that I asked yesterday, but you may have an answer, which is if we had, so I don't disagree with you, but if we had the extra time in Parliament, would anything really change? Mm-hmm. Would the Parliament, to Alan's point, there's been such, how many times did Theresa May?
Three times.
Mm-hmm. And every time it got rejected. Mm-hmm. So with more, the idea, and I'm not supporting it, but I'm just saying his idea is, if we have less time, there's less of a backlash, then I can just go in and do what needs to be done.
All right. So here's the absolute fundamental issue with the UK.
Yes.
They don't really have a functioning democracy.
Well, right. They don't have a constitution.
They don't have a written constitution.
No.
Their laws, the human rights laws, were based in the European Union structure, in the Court of Human Rights. They have still law judges that are life appointments. I mean, there are so many things. Well, life appointments as in peers, like they inherit titles and things like that.
Yeah, but we do have life appointments on the Supreme Court of the United States. And if Trump is reelected, you're going to have seven.
We might have that,
seven out of nine.
So we have in the UK these really traditionalist patterns. We don't have full participation of communities in electoral processes. We have something that's called devolution. Parts of the country have some influence. However, the Northern Irish traditionally and the Scottish have not been integrated in the political debate as much as the English.
Okay.
And
okay,
so we have a lot of problems in the UK.
The prorogation, so the suspension of Parliament, has been now taken up by the Scottish courts.
What was the word prorogation?
So the Scots are going to actually now get heavily involved in this, and that should be an interesting turn.
That should be interesting,
because that's been a very weak court traditionally, and now suddenly they're really stepping forward.
And now they might actually call for independence. I mean, this is the path,
possibility.
That they are pursuing. They had an attempted vote for independence in Scotland a while ago, and that failed, and now they have perhaps an opportunity to pursue that again if the Scottish nationalists engage in this kind of a conversation. So,
all right, so tell us what we're going to do. Tell us where we are. I mean, you have done a remarkable job of telling
us.
No, you've done a remarkable job of telling us what's going on. Nevertheless, the Brits, like everybody else, have to face the reality of what they are going to do now. And you are the closest thing we have to an expert on our panel. Because of what you do. So tell us what should happen.
Well, if I happen to be an organizer in the UK, I'd be pursuing mass public protests which have begun, because this is about the only thing you can do
What are they protesting?
Exactly.
They're protesting the closure,
shutting down Parliament,
and saying this is
Well, Parliament's been open all this time under Theresa May, and it doesn't seem to have led anywhere either. So,
say nothing of Mitch McConnell here with the United States Senate, as if there's a permanent silent veto on any kind of congressional action.
But
right?
One thing that can really happen through public protest is that people who are currently in the administration in the UK might actually reflect on their position, and especially if they have doubts about certain things. Public protests on a mass scale can weaken this current administration and have people resign. And I think we will see resignations, and then that government, the Johnson government, might collapse.
Okay, it collapses. Okay, so it then collapses. What? Then what? Thank
new
you,
elections.
Corbyn. New elections. Yeah.
Corbyn comes in. That's going to fix things.
No, I mean, they basically have to come up with a.
Theresa May comes back. It's like whole thing is a circle.
It could be, but
David Cameron back and just let him hold this bag after creating this mess.
But here is what we want to pay attention to now. Who among the general pockets of opposition is beginning to collaborate with each other against Johnson? And if they have an agreement among some of the Northern Irish, the Scottish, and the Labour Party and some of the other players, they might actually find a new basis for collaboration.
So what's the way out? In other words, in the end, there has to be some, you say, collaboration towards what end? What are they going to do?
So, Alan, there's really two kind of obvious ways this thing can go. And the problem is the Brits like us are split so closely that it's very hard to make either of these happen. Right. It's either going to be a no-deal Brexit, or it's going to be something that gets a new election, which will again be a close election. And a lot of people think Remain would win this time because you had exactly the thing that happened in the U.S.
A new referendum. But that would probably also take, obviously, that would take a new prime minister.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes,
well,
it would.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm saying. So in other words, one possibility is this gamble pays off. You get to a no-deal Brexit. Everyone says, okay, now we got to live with it, and they start moving forward again. The other one is this gamble doesn't pay off, and you end up with a new election that's going to lead to a new referendum. The interesting thing, talking to a lot of my British friends, is that they had very much the same kind of generational thing we did in the election, that just a bunch of people who were in favor of Remaining just didn't take it very seriously.
Right.
They were 30s and 20s and didn't vote. So the percentage of voters who came out in that age range was very low compared to the number of protesters in that age range. So again, I think like us,
at least they didn't have to worry about Russian interference.
I think that the big question is going to be same as here, right? Who comes out? Do we see these new voters just making noise, or do we see them voting? And
so
if they vote, it can change. It'll be interesting.
And
to see.
I agree with you that the young, it really matters for young voters, right? Because for them, what they see is my parents or my grandparents, you know, had a future to look forward to. Our future looks constrained in terms of travel. It looks like the British pound has lost value. It looks like our economic opportunities are decreasing. And anything that was discussed about national health care and those kinds of issues lacked a basis in reality, data, and information.
So what's you're terrific at explaining what's happening, but what I'm interested in is what's gonna happen, and what I'm interested in is
Alan, what's gonna happen in the U.S.? Very similar situation.
Well, I know what's gonna happen. I know what's gonna happen in the U.S. Trump is gonna get thrown out. He is. I don't see any way that gets avoided.
So how about this? I'm going to go out on a limb and say there's a higher and increasing chance that Boris Johnson is going to be a very short-term prime minister.
Okay, then what?
We just discussed it.
I was going to make a vote, I would say right now that Johnson gets no-deal Brexit. falls and then gets elected out. And then
and then the mayhem comes.
Then the mayhem
comes. You know, I think you're exactly right. I think it's going to be no deal Brexit.
Wait, wait, you agreed with me, Alan?
I do. I think that's where it's going to go.
Who first? Can you make
Because there are no other open doors. The guy gets elected. He's going to stick with his guns. He's probably wrong in that it'll solve anything or do anything good, but he'll get his way. I agree with you.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up, and we'll have the governor on at 10 o'clock. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Governor Andrew Cuomo coming on with Alan Chartok at the top of the hour. So we have about 6 or 7 minutes to figure out some other things. We talked about England. So let's talk about how things are so much better in Italy.
Now the food is better.
Well, I can't. I disagree with you there. New government talk shape in Italy, sidelining Salvini and the hard right.
You disagree that Italian food is better?
No, he can't disagree.
No, I said I can't disagree. No.
Oh, can't. Okay, sorry. I'm not.
No. Wow. You have those headphones on.
As an Italian, of course, and an eater, I had to.
No,
defend.
I can't disagree with that. No, okay. Having enjoyed both cuisines extensively, I will say that no, they have to have the upper hand.
Okay, get back now. I'll shut up.
Now I just want to talk about Italian food. Italy's warring political party struck a deal late Wednesday to form a new government that shunted aside the hard right leader Matteo Salvini, who dominated the country's politics for more than a year and threatened to drastically reorient Italy's place in Europe. What now?
Can I make it? I want to tie something together. I could be wrong, but I'm going to try. Alan often says when we talk about Trump, particularly about his mental acuity or lack thereof, but he got elected. And before he mentioned Johnson, but he got into the beat of prime minister. And now you have this guy in Italy who was apparently going to be on the outs, but he's on that same side of the aisle as are Johnson and Trump. And I would suggest to you, yes, they did get in. Yes, the public was fed up for any number of reasons and wanted to try something new. And now they've had a taste of it and they're going to go the other way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but Ira, I have the right of reply, I think, here.
I didn't say anything critical about you. I was just...
Well, here's what I think you were saying. Alan frequently says, but he got elected, as if I'm being defensive about the president, this particular president. Now, anybody who knows my work and anybody who knows what I've had to say about Donald Trump knows that isn't true. The fact of the matter is that people always are saying he doesn't know what he's doing. And I have said again and again, yeah, I don't like what he's doing, but he knows what he's doing. He knows about throwing red meat to the masses. He knows about all of that stuff, and he got himself elected.
Right, and I'm saying he got himself elected because the public was swayed by it, and they tried him, and now we're going to see what we hope is going to happen, which is it didn't work. The public is turning in.
I agree with that, but I want everybody to know that in no way is my role, along with Vera's, as a political scientist looking at what happened, is not an endorsement of the guy. That's the point.
So going back to Italy for a second, I actually found this very encouraging.
Because
like so much of the world right now, you have these authoritarian, nationalistic parties growing. Italy has no tradition of that other than, say, Mussolini. They went through Berlusconi.
That is a tradition. Wait a minute.
That's my point.
Berlusconi was there a long time.
But so I'm saying. So Italy has actually been a country that, for a lot of political reasons, has been split often, but has very often endorsed that authoritarian side.
Yes.
And it's very interesting now to see this happening, because two or three of the opposition parties who hate each other got together and said, look, for the good of our country, we have to start working together and get rid of this guy. And that was actually something that, you know, again, I don't know the internal politics of Italy, but as it plays out and as my European friends are telling me, it's a good sign, simply because you're looking at now split oppositions starting to realize that their power is when they get together. And we're having that same conversation here, right? If we're going to end up with, you know, the sort of progressive versus the...
The Italians have a taste for shaking up things. I believe the voters there love this. Let's go from one extreme to another. Let's have opposition all fighting with each other. And they may be right in that. You know, the government that's gridlocked doesn't do damage. It's when you have a unified party and it's powerful that you get you're unhappy. I thought that this current government was a disaster after Berlusconi, which they still have not recovered from. And why did they go back to this? And you're right. It's like, okay, they shook their head and said, oh, right, what are we thinking? Let's go back.
And in many ways, I think I want to say two things. First, related to the refugees that have been arriving on the southern coast of Italy. This has been a dominant topic in Italy, especially among those that are deeply conservative to the fact that they're almost sort of embracing sort of, you know, fascist principles of not wanting any people in from the south. And we had several boats that arrived. And this was a big internal discussion. People fought over it. And now they agreed they have to collaborate to find actual humanitarian solutions to the problem. Let's see if these kinds of principles are also arriving on the shores of the UK. I find Italy encouraging right now because it might send a signal to people in the UK on how to address their internal problems.
Yeah, all right, we have to. We got to go to the governor, who is on the line. So my thanks to everybody for being here. Rosemary, Vera, Jim, Ira, thank you all. We're going to take a break. We'll get the governor on the line, and we will be right back after this.